You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, brought to you by Full Sneak Gear. Check out their entire lineup at fullsneakgear.com. Also, be sure to check out our entire stable of podcasts at sportsmansempire.com. Whether you're hunting the back 40 or chasing game deep in the backcountry, the all-new Razor Guide Pack from Outdoor Edge has it all. Coming in at only 12 ounces and in a premium wax canvas roll pack for compact storage and travel, the Razor Guide Pack is 7 blades in total, including a 5-inch replaceable blade folding knife, a 3-inch replaceable blade caping knife, and the flip and zip saw for wood or bone. For more information, visit OutdoorEdge.com. New from Moultrie Mobile, the Feed Hub offers first-of-its-kind cellular connection and control for nearly any spin cast feeder on the market. When used with the Moultrie Mobile app, you can monitor feed and battery levels, run feeders on demand, receive alerts when feeders are clogged, and remotely adjust feeding times. The Feed Hub is ideal for anyone who maintains feeders. Remove the guesswork and save time by planning feeder maintenance before you drive to your hunting property. For more information, visit MoultrieMobile.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. I only have nine fingers. That's why the name of this podcast is called the Nine Finger Chronicles. Now, why does that matter? It doesn't. It doesn't matter at all. It's just the title, because I have nine fingers. Therefore, I titled the podcast Nine Fingers. You get it. All right. So we got a good episode today, right? And the theme of this podcast is about purchasing land. You know, hunting land. And so there's no better person to talk to than a loan officer, right? And today we're going to be talking with Cody Kaiser. He lives in Kansas. He is the vice president of a bank. He's a loan officer at that bank. And he talks to us about all the tips and tricks and what to expect when applying for a loan, the different styles and kinds and types of loans that you can apply for that may make it easier for you to get land, and then what kind of hoops you may expect to jump through to get certain types of loans, right? And so if you're just going to have a piece of property to hunt, that piece of property, you know, you won't be able to get any type of special loans. But if you say you are an owner operator and you're going to plant some corn or some beans or do, you know, some certain things, maybe run cattle, then you might have an opportunity to apply for different loans. And some of those loans are, you know, government backed, and they have lower interest rates, and you may be able to get cheaper money, as Cody puts it. So it's a really good episode. I learn a lot. The first half of the episode is me and Cody BSing about Kansas. We talk about how there is like a small bodied genetic in certain parts of Kansas that runs up through Oklahoma and Texas. We talk about how close is too close when hunting the property borders. We talk about trespassers. We talk about a whole bunch of different things about Kansas. And then we get into the meat and potatoes of the episode, which is about purchasing lands and loans available for that. It's a unique episode. It's an educational episode. I hope you guys enjoy it. I know that at some point in my life, I would love to be a landowner. I would love to own some portion of land that I could hunt, whether that's, you know, a 20 or a 40, and then slowly start to sell and, I don't know, sell it and then move it from like a 40 to a 60, from a 60 to an 80, from an 80 to a 100, whatever, you know, jumps that a guy could possibly make. But it just becomes difficult every single year. And I explained to this that the 20% that I need to have for a down payment keeps going up, and it keeps going up, and it keeps going up. And so that 20% for the same amount of acreage, you know, as land prices, especially in the county that I live in, they've just exploded. And there's no way that you're going to get your money back on a land purchase anymore, especially in this county, from the price of farming or whatever. So very interesting conversation. Let's get into the commercials real quick. Tethered. If you are looking for a saddle, go check out Tethered Nation, tetherednation.com. Tethered has, you know, very high quality saddles, climbing sticks, platforms, all the saddle hunting accessories that you need. So do me a favor, go over there and check out Tethered. Wasp Archery, discount code for Wasp Archery is NFC20. That's 20% off. NFC20. Most of their heads are still made in America. I'm a huge fan of the Jackhammer and the Boss 4-blade fixed blade. Please go check out all their mechanical and fixed blade options, wasparchery.com. Vortex Optics. Not only do they have a killer lineup of optics, and we're talking spotting scopes, rifle scopes, range finders, binoculars, and red dots, they also have their Vortex gear line, and it's a lifestyle brand. It's an apparel line. Awesome t-shirts, jackets, raincoats, sweaters, hoodies, baseball caps, even socks. And it's legit, very comfortable, very affordable. And so go check out, you can find all that on vortexoptics.com. And then we have Hunt Stand. As far as hunting app goes, not only is Hunt Stand the most affordable, but with all the functionality that it offers, it is also the most popular. And it's popular for a reason, because it has updated satellite imagery. It has all the good stuff, right? All the stuff that the core, the baseline stuff that you need, like property owner information, property boundaries, public and private land options. And then it also allows you to upgrade to the Pro Whitetail platform, which is the next level for serious bow hunters or serious whitetail hunters. So go check out huntstand.com. And last but not least, the old Woodman's Pal. This machete or this habitat tool, if you haven't gone to their website and checked it out, woodmanspal.com, I can see myself keeping this on my hip during the summer months to clear out some shooting lanes, maybe to hack some poison ivy vines, or hack some shooting lanes, to hack vines that have grown up over my trail cameras, chop some grass out of the way. Just a handy tool that should be left in your truck, or you can put in your pack and take it anywhere you go, just in case you need a heavy duty machete type product. And there's only one way to find out what that is. Oh, well, first off, it's made in America, so that you know the durability's there. And then it's the company itself has been around since 1941. And so, again, that's a long time. And you can tell just by holding it in your hand that it's very well crafted, very well manufactured, and it's been around that long for a reason. So woodmanspal.com. And that's it. If you want to do me a big favor, please go support the companies that support this podcast. Let them know that you heard about their company and their products through the Nine Finger Chronicles. And that just comes full circle. And then these guys work with me again, and then I can get paid by them, and then I can continue to put out free content. So if you guys have any questions about the products that we discussed today, hit me up on Instagram and I'll give you my honest feedback. No doubt, honest feedback. All right, commercials are over. Let's get into today's awesome podcast with Cody Kaiser. 3, 2, 1. All right, on the phone with me today, Mr. Cody Kaiser. Cody, how we doing, man?
Good. How are you, Dan?
Doing good. All right, so first off, we're just gonna get right into it. Where do you live, and what do you do for a living?
I live in Kansas, kind of south central, southeast, kind of on that line. And I am a vice president of ag and commercial lending at a community bank.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Hence why you're on the podcast today. We're going to talk about purchasing land here in a little bit. And now, let's see, Kansas. I applied for Kansas this year, and I am like on pins and needles, just kind of waiting to see. I already drew South Dakota. I have one preference point when I applied. So from everybody else that I've talked to, it seems like I have really good chance of hunting Kansas this year.
Yeah, typically from everything I've heard, one preference point is pretty well going to get you there, but I think two is kind of a for sure deal, which is really crazy for us. I mean, as far as that goes, that's kind of a new deal for Kansas. And I've got some outfitting customers that have dealt with reduced tag numbers because of things like that. So
yeah, for sure. Let's see here. Southeast Kansas. My uncle lives in Southeast Kansas. If you've listened to the podcast, you probably know that. Talk to me a little bit about Southeast Kansas or the areas that you hunt in Kansas from a whitetail standpoint, and talk about, like, here, I'll just say this. Southeast Kansas and Kansas in general, I feel like you have the opportunity, similar to Iowa, to run into a giant if you play your cards right. Is that a true statement? Are there parts of Kansas that are better than others?
Yes and no. It depends on what you're looking for. I will say Kansas, you can find big racked deer kind of all across the state in pockets. I mean, obviously it's, you know, in like any other big buck state, Iowa, Ohio, any of those, they're out there. The area that I'm at, we're kind of at the foot of the Flint Hills rather, sorry. And we are far more cattle country, and with the, I don't know what it is, but I had talked to Brandon Adams about it in the past. Our little pocket right here at the end of the Flint Hills has some of the smallest bodied deer in the state. They can still get some really nice racks on them. But as far as body size go, they're this pocket or this area, and I don't know what it is, but Brandon had tried to explain it to me that something about the genetics and how it runs kind of it kind of starts up here and then runs down through Oklahoma and into Texas. It's just a smaller bodied variety of whitetails, which is kind of different, and I had never, I guess, really paid attention to that, but. As far as rack size, yeah, I mean, you can, and I'll be the first to say that, you know, everybody's like, oh, you can kill a 150, 160 every year. And it's like, yes and no. I mean, those are definitely out here. And but I don't want everybody, you know, I don't want everybody to think that there's a Boone and Crockett behind every tree. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's not the case even in southern Iowa. So as far as the deer population is concerned, right? Here's what it's good that you said this, right? You have this little outshoot of smaller bodied deer that comes up into, into Kansas. I used to think Kansas was a big bodied deer state. You know, I used to think, you know, that it would be, it's a regular occurrence for someone to shoot a 300 pounder or see a 300 pounder. I think I've shot one 300 pounder here in Iowa, but when it comes to Kansas, I also have heard, and most of this information comes from my uncle, they have, you know, they have the big antler deer, they have an older age class, but the quantity of deer is not as much. Is that what you see where you're at?
Kind of, sort of. It's kind of, out there being in cattle country, we've got pockets. I mean, because there's some areas that, I mean, yeah, you're going to see deer there, but, you know, on a good day, you might see 5, 6, 10 deer. And then there's other pockets where if you're there on, you know, pretty much any given day, you're going to see anywhere between 15 and 20. So, again, this area, Kansas, is kind of different than a lot of other places. I would almost, and I'm probably going to get some hate mail for this, but I would almost put it more kind of on like the western side of the state as far as quantity goes, just because with it being cattle country and you know, running timber draws and bottoms and stuff like that, these deer are have bigger home ranges. They're spread out more. And I think that does kind of decrease the density of them. But like I said, in pockets, you know, you get some of the stuff where it's like our property is overgrown cattle pasture that got turned into a hunting property. That's, you know, we got quite a few deer, but just south of us, you know, those people have kind of cleared out some of their stuff, and I don't see near as many deer on their stuff as I do along the other open pastures right along the timber draws and stuff. So they're in pockets,
right?
I guess is,
yeah, man. You know, I've hunted in a active farm for several years, right? Horses, and then once the crops come out, the cattle move in, and they're in the, you know, the picked beans, or they're in the picked cornfield, and then they bring the hay in. So it's definitely an active farm. What's the trick? And I mean, how much of an impact do cattle actually have on deer movement? I mean, if there is, let's just say there's a pasture with cattle in it, are they going into there, or are they staying out?
No, they'll be in there. And you know, Kansas is obviously a bait state. It's legal here on private property. And on one of the farms that we've hunted, that guy runs, he puts deer on there, or sorry, puts cattle on there all deer season. So he puts them in there basically October 1st and runs them all through. They winter on that piece. And so we had to fence off little areas where we had feeders, and just to try to concentrate the deer and give, you know, some type of similar of way to pattern them, because it was just, it's wide open country.
Yeah.
But they would come in, and if cows walked by or something like that, they'd run off and they'd be gone. Cows would meander around, they'd pass on through, and, you know, 5-10 minutes later, the deer come right back out.
Yeah.
As far as traveling, what I've seen is if the cattle are in one area and the deer need to go, they'll just move around them. I mean, they're not going to walk right through them or nothing, but I mean, they're not going to, I guess they're not going to totally avoid that area.
Gotcha. Gotcha. What's the soil like there, out of curiosity?
Heavy clay, probably clay loam combination. Not real great, but not the worst, I guess. Yeah. It's again, it depends on the area you're in. If you're in, get a little bit closer to the Flint Hills, it gets pretty rocky. Mm-hmm. And that heavy clay is, gets real hard to kind of do anything in.
Yeah. Yeah. What is it about Kansas that you feel makes it one of the states that some would call the upper echelon of whitetail hunting?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I would have to say that, you know, us being a one buck state probably helps with that. Mm-hmm. The amount of ag that we have, and I would say probably the ability to get them. In most cases, you got a little bit older age class, but again, that's in pockets as well. And I can contradict every one of those things
Yeah.
with personal experiences and stories as well, to where, you know, where we're at, there's a bunch of outfitters down here, and there's a bunch of people from the Northeast that come back down here and hunt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've never seen a decent bodied deer or a decent rack deer. And they're shooting the first year and a half, 2.5 year old deer that they see that's got, you know, 8 or more points on it, and thinking that it's a giant. And it's like, man, if you just let that deer go a couple more years, he probably could have been, you know, or at least on his way.
Right.
And so that's, I don't know, man. It's kind of, cause you can see that everywhere. I mean, Iowa's got lots of ag country, and you guys are a 2-buck state, and you guys still have damn big deer. Mm-hmm. And it's probably, you know, I mean, obviously it's probably the pinnacle of deer hunting. So I don't know if us being a 1-buck state does that, or if it's just the diversity, kind of across the state, because we do have farm country and cattle country kind of intermixed and intertwined, and maybe that allows these bucks to kind of stay hidden. I'm not exactly sure, but I could make an argument for every one of those things, I guess.
Yeah. So landowners, they don't get an extra tag. It's just one buck all year round, whether, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's only 1 buck for, and that's for all year, right? You can shoot it with a rifle during the rifle season, or you can take it with a bow during archery season.
Correct. The way the resident works is we have what they call any deer, any season tag.
Okay.
So that's our antlered deer permit. And then we can also buy game tags, which are antlerless tags as well. But yeah, we get one buck tag. That's for everybody in the state, residents and non-residents. And then the only way that you can, which again, it only is only one per person, but say that my brother and I, we only own 80 acres, but if we owned 160 acres, we could each get a landowner tag. You're allowed one landowner tag per 80 acres that you own. But again, that's still only like one person's tag. So if I hunted and my brother did not hunt, I would still only be able to get one tag, but I could get a landowner tag at a reduced rate.
Okay. So the possibility to kill multiple bucks is there in the state. It's just you have to own over 80 acres, 80 acres or more.
No, you could still only kill one buck. It's just whoever owns the land, you can get.
So you wouldn't buy a state tag. You would buy your landowner's tag.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. All right. Sounds good. And it's still 1 buck. All right. So it's the same tag, just at a discounted rate because you're a landowner.
Right.
Okay.
Right. All right. Exactly.
All right. Makes sense. On the farm that you hunt specifically, talk to me about what a typical buck is, or your goal every year. You know, what's the buck that you're trying to shoot every year?
We've tried to, our property is constantly a work in progress. We're trying to manage it, obviously, you know, create better habitat and that kind of deal. And our goal is really just age. We don't necessarily have a, you know, antler goal, you know, as far as size. Really, we're just trying to shoot mature deer.
Okay.
And right now, for as dependent, I guess you could say, we are on the neighbor's crop rotation and bedding cover and browse and that kind of stuff. Deer really just kind of pass through our property mainly. And that's why we're trying to improve it to kind of hold some of those and get more of them here. But anything, you know, typically we would like to shoot 5.5 or older, but typically if it's 4.5 or older, we're kind of going after it.
Yeah.
And we've even chose to go after some 3.5 year olds. Frankly, we probably shouldn't have, but we have because of the size of them and the way that people hunt around us, whether that be legally or illegally. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there has been a few instances where, you know, I hate to say it, but it's like, you know, if everybody's like, well, if I don't shoot him, my neighbor will. And it's like, well, sometimes we're that neighbor too. Yeah. And I think everybody is in certain instances, but
I mean, that's a fair statement. That's a fair statement. I mean, for me to pass up a certain caliber of deer, like, you know, there's what I call a teeter totter, right about 145, 4 year old, anything less than that, I'm probably going to pass. But if it's right around there, man, it's, you know, obviously I want it to be a 4 year old, but if it's anything close to that, or it looks good, let's say 145 inch 8-pointer versus 145 inch 10-pointer. We're talking a little bit different of an animal there as far as rack size is concerned.
Right.
But you know, I'm in the mode where, like, if it's close, I'm going to probably shoot it. If it's close to what my goals are, I'm going to probably shoot it. Or if it's close to the caliber of deer that I'm currently chasing, I'm probably going to shoot it. And so this new farm that I got access to this year is 100%, if I don't shoot it, they will shoot it type scenario. Because the guy told me, hey, you know, I only try to shoot 160s. Well, then I get to talking to him, and he's like, well, I let my buddies hunt here as well. And, you know, and they're shooting 140s. And so he was trying to talk me into passing one, like anything less than 160. Meanwhile, he's letting guys on his property shoot 140s. And so, if there's a stud four-year-old, like if I owned the other farm, or if I had access to both farms, I'd probably let that buck walk. But now that I know that in the late season, this deer is going to get smoked, I'm definitely shooting him. So, you know, so I don't know, it is what it is. And it's kind of a personal preference, and everybody changes their mind every single year, unless you are that large acreage landowner who can pass deer, and you know they're not going anywhere. They're just going to stay on your property. So,
well, and that's kind of what we've ran into, man, is we've had years where we've had several good bucks show up. And it really, again, it just kind of depends on who's in the neighborhood. But, you know, on the years that our neighbor has corn, I don't get any early season picture of deer, like none, like no velvet pictures. And until that corn is cut, we don't, I mean, it's a crapshoot. So it's like, we don't even typically hunt early season. Cause we open up, I think typically like the second Saturday or something like that in September. So it's like a September 14th, 17th, somewhere in there kind of time frame. But if there's still corn on the neighbors, it's not even worth messing with.
Right.
But if they have beans, then we get really good velvet pictures. So depending on some of that stuff. And then, like I said, we've got neighbors that basically hunt 15 yards off of our fence line. And there's been, I'm trying to think of what year it was. It might've been 4 or 5 years ago. We had probably 6 deer get shot by the neighbors surrounding us that I knew of.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those were 3.5-year-olds that were pretty studly, you know, coming up, would have been great, great deer, to keep around, and ones that we had passed. And then some of those were older deer that we were targeting and stuff like that. And, you know, I can shoot you picture after picture after picture. The neighbor killed this one on this day. The neighbor killed this one on this day. This guy over here shot this one.
Right.
You know, and it was, I mean, I don't even think we shot a buck that year because everything that we were after just got hammered.
Yeah. Yeah. Those are always tough conversations. Are you in communication with the surrounding landowners to talk with them about what they're shooting versus what you're shooting and what you're trying to do versus what they're doing?
Um, kind of, sort of, because a lot of the landowners out there, at least within, you know, our immediate borders, none of them actually hunt. They've all got it leased out.
Okay.
So
now you have a complete different dynamic, right?
Exactly.
And so I'm leasing this property. I can do whatever the hell I want to type scenario.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Especially if they're short-term leases. Is it roughly the same people hunting it the same year? They'd like have long-term leases, or is it short-term?
It seems to be a little bit of both. Somebody will lease it, you know, for 2, 3, 4, 5 years maybe. And then it's like they move on and go somewhere else. Okay. Or typically out there, what's happened is the older generation has passed on. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, their kids are taking stuff over. And so they're like, you know, we're either going to raise the price on this, or we're going to sell it, or something like that. So it's typically changing hands on multiple fronts, as far as either lessees or landowners themselves, or different things. So it's kind of been kind of both, I would say.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that's a difficult conversation to have, especially if you're rotating through different people every so often. What does the guy who actually owns the property say? Does he even care one way or the other about age class?
No, he's basically, every landowner out here is like, oh yeah, I saw a good deer over here and I saw a good one over there, you know, shoot them all. And it's like, well, we don't really want to do that. It's like, we're trying to get, you know, a good herd established.
Right.
And yeah, we shoot, you know, we all try to shoot a 2 to 3 does a year to kind of help keep the population in check. But, you know, these farmers out here, they're just, you know, they're the good old boys that, you know, if they felt like deer hunting, they're going to take their rifle out. And when they're feeding cows, if they see a deer, they're going to shoot it. And as long as it's quote unquote deer season, whether that be archery season or any other, you know, they don't care. They don't give a shit. They're just, it's my land. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And that's how it is. Right.
You brought up an interesting question, and I always have this internal debate, and that is from a stand placement, right? I've heard stories of guys, you know, for example, I'm not going to say an example. How close is too close when it comes to stands and fence lines and property borders?
Dude, that's a sticky, very, very sticky situation. Exactly. I mean, I don't know. I just, I guess it boils down to the ethics of the person.
Right.
And the reason I say that is because we've had instances on our property where I am 99.79% sure that the neighbor trespassed on our property.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this because my trail cameras were turned off and the memory cards were cleared out, they were anywhere between a week to 2 weeks behind the other cameras.
Okay.
Because typically, you know, when I run cameras, I'll go pull all the cards at once, put new cards in, and then go back to the cabin and go through the cards. And there's been multiple instances where, like our ground blinds, my brother and I leave all the windows open in our ground blinds. There's been times where we've gone out there and all the windows were zipped back up.
Yeah.
There's been other times where, before my grandpa passed away and he would rifle hunt out there, we would set his blind up when we'd set our stuff up, but we'd leave all the windows closed because grandpa wasn't going to use it until rifle season,
right,
which is in December. So, you know, later in November or whatever, we'd go open the windows up for him and kind of get the deer used to it. But we'd try to keep it closed up before that.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times we'd go by there in, you know, October, early November, and the windows are open. And then, like I said, the trail camera thing, that, And it just seems like the places where people are close to fences, they're running feed or putting feed out in areas that's like the farthest away from where our feed is. And so, like I said, that's to me, I guess that's kind of borderline on if that's the ethical thing to do.
Yeah.
But you know, and we can sit here and piss and moan about it all you want, but to each their own, you know, it's legal. So
And that's
what
the
are you gonna
issue.
do?
That's the issue that I'm going to be running into this year. So I have one full season under this new farm. I know how the deer leave this block of timber that is on the property that I have access to. They come into the wide open, and then they cross a fence into an egg field. And that was my late season. However, there's a little strip of trees right along the fence line. I would say if I put a stand in a tree, I would be probably 5 or 10 feet, so somewhere right in there, off the fence line. Okay. Now, could I possibly shoot onto their land? Yes, I would have a shot opportunity, but I wouldn't do it. Okay. I would, however, be waiting for the deer to come out of this property, and I'd be shooting them, knowing that when I shoot them, they're going to run onto the neighbors. Right. And so, I don't want to stir the pot, but at the same time, the other hunter, the landowner, he's got a big tower blind, and I'm guessing it's about 40 yards off the fence line. 40, maybe 50 yards off the fence line. It's there for a reason, because he knows that all the deer bed on that prop on the property that I have access to, and they come to his ag field. And so that's why there's a tower blind there. And so I'm like, well, if you're taking advantage of it, why can't I take advantage of it? And so I don't know. I just feel like there's part of me that understands. You know, because most people, I hate to say I wouldn't give the benefit of the doubt, but if a big buck comes by on the opposite side of the fence, I'm saying most people are going to shoot it, right? I'm saying most people. Now, I don't know, man. It just gets real sticky, and you know, I'll probably avoid doing it because I just don't want any drama. I'll just kill a deer a different, you know, kill a deer a different time. But I know people who have, who they are so adamant about, hey, you're hunting our fence line, you're hunting my property. Well, if the deer are on their property too, you know, like both properties, how is it that you're mad at that? You know, the deer could be coming off mine. So whatever. It's all drama.
It is. And I guess it, you know, going back to the other thing that you could do too is have you talked to that landowner, or have you tried visiting with him about that? I mean, is there, you know, I guess, have you talked to him about if I shoot a deer and it comes on your property, are you cool with me getting it? I mean, is he going to be a dick about it, or is it something that you guys can build a relationship around and everything be okay?
I'll be completely honest with you. I called the guy up. I left a message. I believe I accidentally got a hold of his brother first. And then I got a hold of him, this guy. And he was frustrated, and I could hear in his voice, he was frustrated and disappointed that I now have access to a farm that nobody for the past, you know, 5 years had access to. Nobody could hunt it. So it's been a straight up honey hole property. I got access to it. And now he's frustrated that there's going to be the potential that I'm going to be now. And so I said, hey, I just wanted to be, you know, be up front with you. I wanted to say, hey, and the reason I called him was because I was getting trail camera pictures of a lot of dogs. And I wanted to call him and say, hey, do you have a dog problem? Because maybe we could handle this together, you know, find out where these dogs live, get the landowner to put them on a leash or something. I don't know. But it just sounded like he was more upset that I was hunting there then. And then he also mentioned, say, oh, you got a trail camera right on the fence line. Yeah, it's on the property, right? I can do whatever I want. Why does that bother you? Okay. And so just from the sounds of it, I probably won't be in communication with him. Just from him, like, just, I don't know. He said to me, I'm just really disappointed that there's another hunter here. I'm like, okay, well, there's that.
Oh yeah. You can definitely tell he's probably all sorts of butthurt that you got permission on that property. And you know, he was either probably been trying to get it and didn't know about it or something like that.
Well, he's also a non-resident. So he can't hunt there every year except for the late season, right? Most of the time you can get a late season tag. And I think he can hunt every late season, but he can't hunt the archery seasons every year. And that's in a five-year unit down there.
Right.
And so now a guy comes in and there's a potential that I take the top tier buck out every couple of years. And then he's left with whatever's left over. And so, I don't know. Just instead of feeling happy, it's another instance of instead of feeling happy for someone, there's greed and jealousy involved. And really that's what, I mean, this sport is kind of gross that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, well, and, you know, kind of back to what we were talking about before, dealing with, you know, your neighbors and building relationships with people that are leasing it or having permission on us or on property next to us. We became friends or acquaintances, I guess, depending on how you want to put it. Probably, I'd say we were probably friends with the kid and a couple of his buddies that hunted on the side of us. And hell, there was times like we even went and helped them track deer and helped. We used our ranger to get it out for them, you know, because they shot it way back in the timber and they were having troubles tracking it and all that stuff. And, you know, I wouldn't say that they're new at hunting, but I would say that they've only got a couple years of experience and that kind of stuff. So they called us, we went and helped, and you know, there's three of us that went out there and helped them track a deer and pull it out and load it up and hauled it for them. And, you know, I mean, we were happy for them, even though it was a deer that we'd had pictures of, we'd all decided to pass, but it's like, hey man, you do you. If that's what makes you happy, you are well within your rights to do that. And I'm just as happy for somebody that's doing that. What pisses me off is the poachers the trespassers or the people that are doing that. You know, that's how they're getting their deer, and that's what pisses me off.
Yeah, I deal with that a lot every year down on my main farm that I've been hunting for 14 years. It's like every year there's a giant. There's a giant that shows up, and every year it just goes missing and doesn't show back up the next year.
Somehow, miraculously, right?
Right. And so you start to hear rumors and – oh yeah, so-and-so, you know, so-and-so. I saw a big buck in this field, standing in this field. Well, if you saw it, then several other people saw it. And then
and then
they drive by every night, and then that deer disappears. And and you know, you can't say it just disappears. But then you start to hear these rumors. It's like, oh yeah, I saw, you know, yeah, one night I saw a guy in the field shining a bright light everywhere. I'm like, what'd you do about it? Oh, nothing. Didn't do anything about it. Okay. Well, now we kind of, you know, you start putting the pieces of the puzzles together. Mm-hmm. There's still some assumptions that are made, but man, I feel like the main farm that I hunt, if I could snap my fingers and go no more poaching and there would be no more poaching, man, I feel like there would be a couple giants every single year on the farm that I have access to. And
that's how I feel about our place. That's exactly how I feel about our place. It's again, like you said, you hear the rumors and you hear people chitting and chatting about certain things and start putting pieces together, man. And it doesn't take long to kind of start figuring that stuff out. And, or, you know, you'll hear of, oh, so-and-so shot this deer. And it's like, yeah, I shot it with my bow. And it's like, really? Did you? And it's, you know, I mean, you're sitting there looking at it and it's like, there is visibly no arrow wound whatsoever. There's no drops of blood anywhere. And you're going, huh, man.
Yeah. What blows my mind about people like that is, let's say they take the shot they kill the deer illegally. And then let's say maybe they do have a tag, and or let's say they trespassed and shot it, or they shot it out of season, or they shot it, they poached it from the road or something like that. They tag it. No one really knows how they got it. You know, it's basically they're saying they shot it. Well, someone shot it. Then they go to the taxidermist, they get it mounted, and they hang it on their wall. And then other people see that potentially and go, God, that's a good deer. What? How'd you get this one? And then they lie to them. And so every time you talk about that deer, you're lying, not only to yourself, but to whoever. And after a while, wouldn't you feel like just lying all the time about it would suck? I don't
know. Oh, dude, I couldn't even imagine.
I feel
like the biggest asshole just
exactly
looking at that deer.
Exactly.
You know, I don't know. I've never, and believe it or not, the couple of deer that I have in my mind thinking about this that have happened on the neighboring property and the guy that did it, he's got them mounted. He's got them on the wall. Yeah. And I know that for a fact because the kids that we were friends with went and looked at them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't know how you could do that. I would, man. I'd look up at that deer and I would be
just reminded.
You know, so ashamed.
Yeah. I mean, you would be reminded daily of a crime you've committed. Right.
Well,
I
yeah. Mean, not right. just that. The fact that you're lying out your ass about it every corner.
And some of these people are just dirtbags, man. They're okay with it. I guess they're just okay with being a dirtbag. So.
Yeah. It's, you know, again, man, I would much rather have somebody shoot a 3.5-year-old deer that we had passed and be, you know, do it legally and be super stoked about it.
Yeah.
Than to lose one of our older mature deer to a trespasser or poacher or something like that. And
exactly.
I will be, like I said, man, we've gone and helped people look for them. We've helped them drag them out and taken pictures with them and, you know, made sure that they got the good picture, you know, like, hey man, like let's cut the tongue off. Let's clean this up. Let's, you know, wipe off his face, like, get yourself some good pictures, you know, and help them do all that stuff and been happy for, like, genuinely happy for them because they were happy.
Yep.
And it's like, I would much rather do that than lose, even if it's just one of our older, you know, 8-9 pointers that's just got those big old fat floppy necks, you know, just mature deer. I'd rather do that than lose one of them to a poacher or a trespasser.
Fact. Oh, well, I guess it's something that people deal with every single day. All right. I want to start talking a little bit about what you do for a living. Okay. Tell us again what your role at the bank is.
My title is a vice president, but really what that is just a glorified loan officer. So I deal with ag and commercial lending and do all sorts of loans. But that's
okay.
You know, we do everything from, like I said, tractor, land, you know, any type of ag loan to commercial building, anything like that.
Okay, so if I came to you and said, hey, I want to buy a hunting property, does that fall under ag or is that like recreation?
Depends.
Okay.
If it is an income producing property, it becomes commercial, which ag is under commercial technically.
Okay.
Because it falls under that income producing. Now, if it does not produce income, then it is purely recreational, and that is a different set of circumstances.
Okay. So let's say I had because I have this podcast and because I use the content that I get from hunting on said property or potentially could, does that then become a commercial property?
Man, that's splitting hairs. That would be something you would need to talk to like a CPA about.
Okay.
Because you could make that argument both ways.
Mm-hmm.
So for it being income producing, like you said, this is your job.
Mm-hmm.
The content that you create using that piece of property is producing income. So technically that property could be classified as income producing. However, the other side of that you could argue against it would be No, the land is just a vessel, essentially. It's just an asset that's sitting there, and you are the one creating the content. Mm-hmm. Therefore, your land is not, it's not generating grains, it's not producing cattle, it's not producing hay, nothing like that. You yourself are the one producing the content. So that would not be considered income producing. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's a really good avenue to talk to a CPA or an accountant about.
Okay. So then income producing, right? Does CRP count as income producing?
I believe so, because that's paid out on a per acre basis usually. Yep. So I want to say that would be classified as income producing. Yes, okay. I think.
And then if I'm the owner, but cash rent out the farm ground to, a guy who's going to do a corn bean rotation, would that be considered income producing?
I believe so, yes, because okay. I have seen people on their taxes where they will claim. So basically for ag, you file what they call a Schedule F, which is your income and your expenses. So for like partnerships, you file a Schedule E. For corporations, you file Schedule C, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So the Schedule F, I've seen people list rental income as other income, and then they're able to write off any of their expenses that they're responsible for. Typically, if you're cash renting something, you're basically just giving them, the rights to either farm it or graze cattle on it. Mm-hmm. Now, if they're grazing cattle on it, you might have an agreement in there where they're responsible for taking care of the fences. Mm-hmm. If they're farming it, you might not have an agreement like that. So if you're the landowner, they're farming it, you could fix the fences, and then you could be able to write that expense off because that's part of your responsibility.
Right.
So it can go either way. It depends on some of the things that are in place, what it's used for, how it's used, that type of stuff. And that's where you kind of get down into the weeds on stuff. And somebody like a CPA or an accountant that knows the tax laws knows what you're legally allowed to do.
Okay. But from a loan standpoint now, okay, you're the loan officer here. Is there a difference in the loan that I would get if I just brought a property and all I wanted to do was shoot deer and ride four-wheelers on it, as opposed to work the land through farming or graze cattle?
Yes.
Okay.
And the main difference there would be the types of programs that you can qualify for.
Okay.
I'm sure that you're aware of the Farm Service Agency. Farm Service Agency that's under the USDA.
Okay.
They have programs that people can apply for, which kind of gives them, for lack of a better term, discounted money. They've got more hoops to jump through and things like that, but typically gives them a cheaper interest rate, a little more flexibility when it comes to down payments and stuff like that. But those have to be owner-operator type transactions.
Okay.
Whereas if you're going to just buy it for recreation, that takes that option completely off the table. You have to deal with a bank 9 times out of 10. There's not going to be any way to get around the standard 20% down. And then you have to show that you can pay for that land without any additional income coming in, because right. It is purely recreational. Whereas somebody who's obviously going to use it for something else that's income producing, they can show that income is going to help make that payment.
Gotcha. Okay. Man, this is where we go. The next question is why you reached out to me in the first place. Because I made a comment on another podcast where I don't understand the loan process, because I could go to a vehicle, brand new, $60,000. The second I drive it off the lot, it depreciates, right? And then every year it depreciates, right? But you'll give me that loan with no money down, right? And essentially, the bank then holds the title for an asset that is losing value every year, as opposed to land, which is for the most part 20-25% down payment, and that asset gains usually every single year or a couple years gains a value. So my question is, what the hell? Like, that's the question. What, like, I don't understand. I would think it would be flipped, that as far as,
well, typically it's because of the longevity of the asset. So if you think of it in terms of, and there's a, I used to know the percentage exactly, but I want to say that it's somewhere like 40 to somewhere in the range of like 40 to 60% of people only keep their vehicle 3 years. Mm-hmm. So if you finance a vehicle, even with 0% down, and you finance it for anywhere from 5 to 6, 7 years, typically nowadays, to for the higher priced vehicles, you're only keeping it about half that time anyways before you're getting something new and you're turning it over.
Yeah.
So that's in most places. Now, obviously, you know, big cities, New York, those places, a car is not something that you absolutely have to have. Mm-hmm. But for most people in most places, you have to have a vehicle. So that, combined with the fact that the longevity of the asset is not near as long, the term of the loan is not near as long, therefore you have a little bit more liberal policies around getting those types of loans. Mm-hmm. And there's generally a little bit more flexibility to kind of get around some of that stuff.
Yeah.
What gets you on land is because very few people are going to finance land in 5 years.
Yeah.
Most of those, you know, you're talking usually, most cases, minimal 15-year, more times than not, 30-year commitment. And that's something that is going to stay around for eternity. You know, land ain't going anywhere.
Right.
So that's kind of the thought process behind why you have to have a down payment for something like land compared to a vehicle. It's usually the longevity of the asset and the fact that the time commitment there is far greater. Right. And typically the value is a lot higher, so the bank has more risk involved in the transaction.
Mm-hmm. But does the bank actually have risk? Because if I default on my loan, you've just gained an asset that can be sold for a higher value than what you ended up getting it for.
So, and yes, so, and no.
Okay. Okay. Are you going to explain that?
Yeah. So here's the thing. And I'm sure that you're probably aware of this in Iowa, is you get out-of-state people that come in, and these big money guys, they're out-of-state. All they want is a deer hunting property.
Yep.
And they don't give a shit about what's going to happen to it. They're going to lease it out for, or cash rent it out, or do it on thirds for farming or running cattle or whatever. They will pay because it's going to help them on their taxes. So they will pay whatever the hell they want to pay for it. If they think that that property, you know, if they go to an auction, they'll bid it up until they make sure that they get it bought. But depending upon the neighborhood that it's in, it might not be worth that much money to the farmer or the rancher because they could never make it cash flow. They could never make it pay for itself.
Yeah.
By the income that it's going to produce.
Yeah.
So if that's the case, say we take over a piece of property, you know, the bank takes over a piece of property. If we turn around and, for one, the expense on repoing it is a pain in the ass because you have to wait basically 180 days. They have to get behind. They have to get past due. I think it's like 90 days. Then you got to wait another 90 days before you can even start the foreclosure process. So now you're 180 days into it. And then you got to go through the whole rigmarole, and you've got to post it in certain places. You've got to post it a certain way, notify certain people within the county or the city, the county, the state, all that kind of crap. which that starts racking up our expenses.
Ours, yeah.
It starts racking up the bank's expenses for all of that, plus the legal expertise, because you got to have a lawyer to deal with it. So then all that gets added back against that loan, against that asset. And if it's in a neighborhood where the farmers say, look, yeah, that's a piece of property, but it's overgrown, it's got a creek running through it, I can't do nothing with it. You know, it's too crowded, it's got too many trees for me to run cattle on, and it's got it's too hilly or got too many trees for me to farm. It's not worth anything to me. Well, if that's what's in the neighborhood, they're not going to pay that for it.
Yeah.
So then you start losing your ass on it. But there again,
so then why would
recreational property?
So then why would the bank allow a loan like that to go through, knowing that it's just like, obviously the land has a value. Okay. The value is whatever someone is willing to pay for it. Right. Anyway, like, hey, dude, I want to overpay $10,000 an acre on this just so I get it. All right.
Right.
Well, they should know that when they go to resell it, there's a good chance that they're not going to make their money back on it because they've overpaid for it. Okay. Potentially. Right. And so, yeah, I'm sitting here trying to argue money with a banker.
So here's typically the way that works is you have to get the land appraised.
Yep.
So just for round numbers, right? Say the property appraises for $100,000, mm-hmm. and you want to make damn sure you get this property bought. So you offer them $150,000. Okay.
Yep.
Well, from a banker's standpoint, I'm going to look at that and I'm going to say, okay, well, for starters, you know, congratulations to you for having that much money, because that was stupid. You overpaid for the land.
Yep.
It's only worth $100,000. So because of that, I'm only going to loan you $80,000, because that's 80%. That's, you know, so if you want to pay $150,000 for it, that's fine. However, you're going to have to come up with the difference yourself. I'm going to give you 80. You can have to come up with the 70 yourself. And that's how the bank protects itself on situations like that. But there again, with it being such a long commitment, the risk is higher, because if somebody does purchase that land, you know, nobody knows what's going to happen tomorrow. You know,
right.
I could be walking to the bank from my truck and get ran over by a semi. Who knows? You know, so if I have a land loan somewhere, that's going to fall to somebody.
Yeah.
You know, and if my nearest relative doesn't know that I have a loan against land, they're not going to make the payment.
Right.
Well, if they're not going to make the payment, then obviously the bank is going to be out that money. So it's things like that,
okay,
that increase the risk, again, along with the longevity of the term that the bankers look at. So,
yeah.
And typically we don't, the kind of the rule for banking is the percentage that you're allowed to loan, which for land, you know, that's what we're talking about, 80%, you know, other things like machinery and equipment, the bank might have a different percentage, like 75%, that you can go up to. And typically the way the banks work is it's either the appraised value or the purchase price, whichever is less. So just like in that example that I gave you, the appraised value was less than the purchase price.
Okay.
But if it's flipped and say the property is worth $100,000 or $150,000 and you're going to get it bought for $100,000, I'm still only going to loan you $80,000.
Okay.
Because the purchase price is less than the appraised price, and I can only loan you 80% of whichever is the less of the two values.
Okay, makes sense. Is I need 20% down. Is there any way around that for purchasing land?
Yes, if you're going to be the owner operator of it.
Okay.
So if you're going to be the one that is going to farm it or going to ranch it, run cattle on it yourself, then yes, there are ways around that. If it is going to be something that you are going to have somebody else do those, then typically no.
Okay. All right. So I see Loophole City coming up out of this, right? Yep. Just like, okay, you may not have to pay the down. Is there a way to get out of the down payment altogether? Or is it just a reduced down payment at that point? If I decide I'm going to farm it.
Again, it's kind of, if you go through the FSA, there's ways they do what they call a 50-50 loan, where the FSA will loan 50% of the purchase price, and you have to get matching funds from a financial institution for the other 50%. Now, again, you have to be the owner-operator, and there are a lot of stringent guidelines that you have to follow that basically prevent you from these loopholes. And it's, you know, when you're dealing with anything with the government, they're going to make sure that you have to jump through all the hoops, obviously, and they don't really give a shit about what happens to them on the backside, right? Because it's the government. So you're going to have to submit your records. You're going to have to submit, you know, a personal financial statement every year, your tax returns every year. You're going to have to show that you have a Schedule F, which is, you know, AGS, income and expense report on your taxes. And if you don't, then basically they can say that you're in default of that loan and they can start a foreclosure process.
Even if I'm making the payments?
Yes. Because if you're showing, like if that was bought for ag purposes through an organization like the FSA or any, you know, farm credit or anything else like that. And again, that I misspoke there. I'm not sure if farm credit does that or not, but if it's done through the USDA FSA office, then yes, if you do not have a Schedule F and you are not showing any income and expense on that property as the owner operator, then you are in violation. And they basically say that you lied on all the forms and you are not upholding your end. So even if you are making the payments on it, you're still in default of the loan. Okay. Typically, again, you kind of got to jump through a bunch of hoops there. And a lot of times they'll say, look, you know, you didn't have any Schedule F this year, so you've got one more year to figure it out, or you've got two more years to figure out, whatever. Yeah. They'll kind of give you a chance to kind of right that ship. But yeah, they're on your ass about it. So, I mean, and especially if there's a house on it, now you start a whole new can of worms. Because now you start getting into even more government regulations because you're throwing around the term primary residence. Mm-hmm. So you start doing that. That starts, like I said, that's a whole other can of worms there. And boy, do things get messy and hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. And so here's what I've this is just my personal experience. It's like, hey, you know, what did they say? The best time to buy land was yesterday. The second best time to buy land was today. Right. And so, cause prices just, they're not going down. And so, but here's the issue. Every time I get a lump sum saved up and I think it's time to start looking for land, the value of land is now going up, meaning that my lump sum is no longer 20% anymore. So that lump sum has to keep going up and up and up and up. And so the reason for that line of questioning was, I know that I could probably pay the monthly, let's just say I'm looking at $100,000, loan in total. There's a piece of ground for $100,000. I know that I could pay the monthly payment on $100,000, but the issue is the 20% down payment. Right. And so is there a way, because what you've just said is that 50-50 loan plus the loan for the actual property, you default on that, or they say, hey, we're going to give you a year to fix it. In the meantime, you can take that and just refinance for a different interest rate under a bigger loan. Is that possible?
Yeah, that would be possible. But typically, what you're losing in rate is going to make it a lot harder to pay for. And again, depending on how long you've had that land, or what it valued at versus what you got it purchased at, some other places, they're still going to want the 20% down in some way, shape, or form. So if you financed 100% of it, you're typically, even if you've got some of it paid down, say you're still at 95% of its value, most places still aren't going to touch that. And if they do, they're going to come back and they're going to say, well, you're going to need to come up with X amount of dollars for us to refinance this. And you ever dealt with credit unions? You ever financed a vehicle or a boat or anything like that through a credit union?
Yeah.
Versus like a conventional bank?
Yes. Yep.
So you know the difference in rates and in terms and kind of very similar on that stuff.
Not really. My house used to be through a credit union. We refinanced it with a commercial bank. So a
Okay.
regular bank. So just for a lower interest rate. Now,
Right.
what happened in this whole process and what we were paying versus what we were not paying at a credit. The only thing I know is a credit union was like, well, we want to make sure you have a checking account with us too. And the other bank didn't give a shit. And so
Right.
whatever that
So,
means.
well, and there again, that goes back to a primary residence. Primary residence is run usually off of a different set of rates, and that's kind of standardized across the board because housing is way heavily regulated, especially since 2008. That kind of runs off of the 10-year Treasury bill. But when you come to consumer notes, vehicles, UTVs, campers, boats, anything like that, I would say a solid 9 out of 10 times a credit union is going to be far less stringent on their policies and have a better interest rate. Now, the reason for that is because a credit union is considered a nonprofit financial institution because they're customer owned. And any money that they make, they're supposed to give back to their customers in the form of higher yields on accounts and lower rates on loans. So that's kind of the difference between, so the FSA going through them, that's like going through a credit union as far as like an auto loan. So the FSA, they're going to give you like a dirt cheap rate, whereas then you go refinance it somewhere else, you're very liable to pay up to twice as much in rate. Plus, then again, you still got to come up with whatever that difference is in the down payment. So there is a loophole there, but you're still going to be, it's still going to kind of hamstring you.
Gotcha. All right, so let me ask this question. I'm going to try to do it as smoothly as possible, but it's not going to happen. How does someone buy land that is there a way to buy land that is the most beneficial for the purchaser? What is the best way to do that?
Buy land most beneficial for the purchase. Oh, so
So right now,
I guess
if I wanted to go to the bank, I'd have to pay 20 down, 20% down, and then I'm subject to the interest rate and for my credit, my credit score, and then that would spit me out, whatever the terms were. Is there an easier way than that?
No,
No.
not really, because you're, like I said, if you go another route, and that's, kind of like we were talking about with the FSA stuff, they're going to make you jump through so many hoops, but they give you a far better interest rate for it. So it's kind of like the, is the juice worth the squeeze? Yeah, because you're getting a far better rate. Whereas if you're going through a conventional bank, you have the money to put down, just go through them, pay your 20% down, you do the loan and roll on. So,
Do
but
food plots
that's
count as me being a farmer?
no,
No.
I tried
Now,
that. I've tried
what if I
that. It
plant a
does not
whole
work.
field and just not combine it?
No, but what you can, what you could do that a lot of people don't think of is like hay production.
Mm-hmm.
You can plant alfalfa, and so go in there and cut hay and sell the hay.
Yeah.
You know, and alfalfa is a good food plot. So start a hay business.
There you go.
You're now an owner operator. You're using a food plot and you're getting something off of it.
Yeah.
You know, something like that.
I plant apple trees and then just sell one apple pie a year.
Well, nope. I've tried that too. I've looked into this the same way that you've talked about, because okay. I myself, like, that's what a lot of people forget. Us bankers, we're not the stodgy asshole on the other side of the desk, you know. We're consumers too,
yeah.
You know. I'm kind of the same way. I couldn't afford a down payment on something, and I've wanted to buy land and do this and do that with it, because, you know, I'm fun side note here. I'm a country boy. I rode bulls for 15 years. I grew up rodeoing and all that kind of stuff. So my whole life has been in ag. And yeah, my brother and I have land that our grandpa passed down to us that's purely for hunting. I would also like to have land so I could run cattle.
Yeah.
You know, that's my goal and my dream. Well, that puts me on the consumer side of things too. And I say all that to say, I've talked to the FSA about trying to buy a house and 40 acres and run cattle on it. And I'm like, well, you know, I can afford to buy, you know, 5 head and put on there. I got told no. And because 5 head is not, quote unquote, a significant investment. And I'm like, well, it is for me. I'm like, that would be a significant to go out, take money out of my pocket to buy, you know, you're talking $10,000 worth of cattle, and make sure the fences are good and all that kind of stuff. That would be a significant investment for me. But FSA says, no, it's got to be a significant amount. And again, who knows? It's the government. You don't know what significant classifies as until they tell you that you hit that limit. So,
right. And at the same time, I bet you there's other people who they looked at their thing and they didn't care that it was just 5 head. It's very objective.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever.
But
the government.
Yeah. Right. But typically in those types of instances, like the FSA, I guess I did leave out one stipulation, is the FSA makes you go to other financial institutions and basically get turned down by them before you can apply for their programs, because it is a government program. It is subsidized through tax dollars. You do have to make an effort, and typically how people get around that is most commercial banks for land, non-primary residences cannot do a 30-year fixed rate loan that they will keep on the books. So they say, no, in order for you to cash flow, you've got to have a 30-year amortization. You're not going to qualify with us. And then the customer goes back and goes, nope, FSA, sorry, the bank told me that I wouldn't qualify without a 30-year fixed rate. That's what I need from you. And then FSA goes, okay, you qualify now. We'll look at your stuff, you know, or you're able to apply for this program. We'll look at your stuff and see if you qualify, type of thing. So that is kind of a big caveat that I forgot there. But
just seems so complex. Like, it seems so complex. Like, I just feel like, and there's so many things that go way over my head when it comes to purchasing land or refinancing a home or getting a loan for a vehicle, where I'm that dumbass who just signs his name, right, without reading anything. And so am I wrong in saying, like, if I wanted to get a loan from a bank, they should literally just look at my income and how much money I may currently have in the bank and go, yes or no, this guy should get a loan. Not like all this other jazz that has to go into it. I don't know. Banking and me, I don't know.
Yeah, I would say no, because, again, being on the banker side of that,
yeah.
There's a lot of things to consider. If it's consumer related, they're going off of your credit report.
Mm-hmm.
They look at typically your W-2 income. They look at your credit report, and they look at what we call your debt to income ratio.
Yep.
Your DTI. If you go commercial side, which is in ag is included in commercial, you have to give 3 years of tax returns, a personal financial statement, a credit report, and then we look at what we call debt service coverage, which is the actual inverse of the DTI ratio.
Right.
So basically you're looking at somebody's credit worthiness is what they call it, but you're looking at their ability to repay their debts. And you know, because believe it or not, there's people that make a lot of money that are shit when it comes to managing finances.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's the kind of thing. And then you've, you know, there's other people that are, you know, frugal as hell, and they could sit here and write a check to buy you a new truck, me a new truck, and them a new house, you know? And it's like, you know, so that's really kind of what financial institutions are looking at.
Gotcha. Well, Cody, man, I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on and talk to us a little bit about Kansas and the process of getting a loan for a piece of property. I hope someday that I can get the 20% that I need, and then I can start shopping. But before I make my decision, land will go up and I'll need more 20%.
I know you probably were probably taking this a little bit longer, but real fast, one thing that you can do is buy a smaller piece of property that's cheaper.
Yep.
Get it fixed up and then flip it. Mm-hmm. Keep it for a few years because it is going to appreciate in most cases. You know, whether that means you fix the fence on it, you put a trail through it, you put a food plot on it, whatever, you could buy a 20 and then sell it and then take that money and use that as your down payment for your 40,
mm-hmm.
buy a 40 acre piece, do the same thing and just continuously flip properties to get there. That's actually a very logical and logistical way to do that.
Yeah.
Or fiscal way. Sorry.
Is there something, man, what was it, like a C something where you could, the first time you sell a property, you can then transfer that debt to, you know, like to a new property without having to pay the 20% down or something like that? Or,
No, what you're thinking of is called a 1031 exchange on your taxes.
Yes.
So what you do is if you don't keep that property for, I can't remember if it's like 2 to 3 or 2 to 5 years, something like that. If you sell it for a profit, you have to pay what we call capital gains on it. Mm-hmm. So to avoid that, you're given a time frame to where you can take those profits. And as long as you roll it into another piece of property, within that given time frame, you do not pay taxes on it.
Gotcha.
And that's called a 1031 exchange. Now, again, I'm not a CPA. Don't quote me on those because go talk to your accountant first before you do those types of things. But that is one thing that people can do. And really, it's again, six of one, half a dozen of the other, because the only way to get out of that is you're going to lose that money somewhere. So either you're going to sell another property and you're not going to make a profit on it, so you don't have anything to pay taxes on, or you're going to continue to make profits on properties. And when you stop buying and stop rolling that over, you're eventually going to, the taxes are going to catch up with you one way or the other. So again, the government's got to get their piece.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. We're going to end it. Thank you very much for your time today and good luck this upcoming season, man.
All right. Thanks, man. You too. Appreciate it.
And there you have it. Huge shout out to Cody. Huge shout out to all of you for taking time out of your day to download and listen. Please go to iTunes, leave a 5-star review, let everybody know how awesome this podcast is. Please also make sure you're following on Instagram. If you have a big buck story that you want to share or just an awesome hunting story that you want to share, please reach out to me and I would love to, have you on the podcast. I love stories. I love storytelling. I love getting information out of people. If you've been on a heater and you've found success over the last 5, 6, 7, 10 years, 20 years, I'd love to hear how you do it. So reach out to me, and I pretty much say yes to everybody who reaches out to me. So I'm looking forward to that. And huge shout out to Tethered, Wasp, Vortex, Hunt Stand, and the Woodman's Pal. If you guys have any questions about those brands, hit me up via Instagram. And that's it. Good vibes in, good vibes out, and we'll talk to you next time. Thank you.